Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, the scandal behind the scandal. We're joined by three investigative journalists for a deep dive into the web of money, politics, and influence that involved not just JEA and FPL, but ghost candidates, surveillance, and a statewide effort to undermine elections. We're going to devote most of the next hour to this topic, and to discuss it, I'm joined by Annie Martin, investigative reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. Welcome, Annie.
Thank you.
Nate Monroe, columnist with the Florida Times Union. Hi, Nate.
Good morning, Ann.
And Mario Ariza, investigative reporter with Floodlight, an independent nonpartisan newsroom. Welcome, Mario.
Good morning, Ann.
So this is a complex story, and it does involve the sale of JEA and city politics here in Jacksonville. But I want to start elsewhere in the state with the 2020 elections. Mario, that was the year that there was a scandal over something called ghost candidates. What is a ghost candidate, and who is Justine Iannotti?
Sure. So a ghost candidate, totally legal in Florida, but it's something, well, legal sort of. Basically, a third party candidate designed to make one other person in that election lose. In Senate District 9 in 2020, there was a third party candidate known as Justine Iannotti. In fact, Annie and the Orlando Sentinel were the first to write about it.
Central Florida candidate.
That's right. Seminole County. In Volusia. And about a month before the election, if you lived in this area, you would have gotten kind of an interesting flyer showing a stock photo of an African-American woman and, you know, with some liberal talking points advertising Justine Iannotti. But that was basically the only campaigning that occurred for Justine Iannotti. She never campaigned herself. She was actually moving to Sweden at the time. And the goal of her entrance into the race, I think is fair to say, was to damage the Democrat in the race and help Republican Senate candidate, now Senator, Jason Broder, win.
She was not an African-American woman, despite the photo that was on the flyer.
She was not.
So she never campaigned. She did end up taking a little over 2% in that race, a very close race that, as you say, Jason Broder won with just 50.3% of the vote. So, Annie, if you're running a phony ghost candidate campaign, as Mario says, it's not illegal. It's only illegal if you try to hide the money, where it came from, where it's going.
That's right. If you run for office in Florida, you get contributions from people who support you. You have to report those contributions so that the public can see who is funding your campaign. In this case, Justine Iannotti reported contributions from four people, including a couple who say that they never donated to her campaign. And that's illegal in Florida. You can't make contributions through someone else or in someone else's name. And so she was arrested, as well as her political consultant and the former chair of the Republican Party in Seminole County, on charges that they fudged her campaign contribution reports. And that is a crime. That's the issue here. It's not that she wasn't a genuine, authentic candidate. It's that they were misreporting her contributions.
And as you say, the then chairman of the Seminole County GOP Executive Committee, also the former mayor of the town of Longwood, Benjamin Paris.
Right.
He was convicted.
Right.
In this case. And there are still a couple of outstanding issues criminally. Can you talk about those?
Right. Ben Paris was convicted on a misdemeanor charge in 2022. And Justine Iannotti actually testified during his trial, as well as his cousin, whose name appeared as a contributor to Justine Iannotti, but he said he never actually gave to her campaign. And Justine Iannotti has also been arrested, and her political consultant has been as well. And they've been charged with felonies. But they are awaiting trial, and they have not been convicted at this time.
So, Mario, Iannotti was not the only ghost. Tell us about the District 37 race in Miami-Dade.
Right. That one featured another ghost candidate named Alex Rodriguez, who shared a last name with the progressive Democrat incumbent senator, Jose Javier Rodriguez. I should note, Alex Rodriguez graduated from my high school, Belen Jesuit. Alex, at the time, was a salesman of hard-to-find truck parts, and the accusation that he's pleaded guilty to was that he accepted around $40,000, $45,000 to run And the guy who gave him that money, former state Senator Frank Artiles, or who is accused of giving him that money, is going to stand trial this June for it. But Alex Rodriguez was incredibly important in the defeat of Jose Javier Rodriguez.
And Jose was the incumbent, sort of the real Rodriguez.
That's right. The real Rodriguez, JJR, as we call him down there. The election came down to a recount, 37 votes, less than 40. And Alex Rodriguez got over 6,000 of them.
The fake Rodriguez.
That's right.
So enormously consequential in terms of siphoning votes from the real Rodriguez. We assume people were not intending to vote for the ghost candidate, the fake Rodriguez, but intended to vote for the incumbent.
Possibly, yeah.
And he was ousted.
He was ousted.
So this, Nate, is where the story gets a little closer to home and to your reporting on all of these issues. The incumbent in that case, the Democrat Rodriguez, had infuriated FPL, Florida Power and Light. Tell us a little bit about what was happening behind the scenes in terms of the power company's concerns about the incumbent Rodriguez.
Yeah, I mean, I think JJR was, frankly, one of the few Democrats in Florida that was kind of unafraid of challenging FPL's legislative agenda. And in his case, I think it was rooftop solar. He was an advocate for, you know, essentially expanding the ability of homeowners in Florida to put solar panels on the rooftops. This is something Florida Power and Light and frankly every utility in Florida doesn't, you know, they want to curtail that. There are some competing interests there. And so we understood, and we actually know now, that JJR had infuriated FPL executives, because we later, after this race, came across emails and batches of records that we got. The CEO of Florida Power and Light told his underlings that he wanted to make JJR's life a quote living hell.
Dot dot dot. Seriously.
Right.
Seriously, right. Yes. And so this FPL CEO that you're referring to, he's since left, Eric Szilagyi, had sent an email to his deputy saying this was after, you know, Rodriguez's effort. In fact, it was in regards to an article about his effort to interfere with this rooftop solar. And Szilagyi later admitted that he had supported the Republican Party, who he knew was targeting this race. But this email, Mario, went to a company VP, whose name we'll hear again later, Daniel Martell. What happened when he got Szilagyi's email?
Within minutes, Daniel Martell forwarded this email to a gentleman by the name of Jeff Pitts. Jeff Pitts, at the time, was the chief executive officer of a political consulting firm based out of Birmingham, Alabama, and other parts of Alabama, known as Matrix LLC. And Matrix, well, they're going to be a major character in this story from here on out. And Jeff Pitts is going to be a major character in this story.
So, Nate, we know that, the CEO of Florida Power and Light sent this email, "I want to make his life a living hell." Soon thereafter, this fake Rodriguez is enlisted to run and ultimately ends up derailing the real Rodriguez's political career. We know this because there were some documents leaked from Matrix to the media. We're going to get to that more, but tell us just briefly what those documents entailed.
Sure. And just to be clear, just to be careful about this one fact, we do not know who leaked these records to us. We know that they are Matrix records. They are internal Matrix records, but we actually never learned who leaked them to us. And we got separate batches of documents. The Times Union got some, the Sentinel got some, and they sort of addressed different issues. It was almost like they were tailored to the reporting interests that we all had, because Matrix is really the connective tissue in a lot of this statewide controversy that seems otherwise pretty discreet. These records were internal. They were internal records from one of the political consultants that Florida Power and Light had hired. And so we're talking communications between Matrix executives and Florida Power and Light executives. We're talking strategy documents, payment ledgers, some financial records. They were these were incredibly revealing documents that were never, ever, ever, ever intended to be viewed by anyone, much less journalists.
So, Annie, as you noted, ghost candidates are not illegal, but hiding the money is. So let's follow the money a little bit. The fake Rodriguez in this case says he was bribed by a former senator to enter this race. Tell us a little bit about the role of Frank Artiles.
Yes. Alex Rodriguez admitted and pled guilty to charges that he took a bribe of $45,000 to run as a spoiler candidate in this race. And he was given that money by Frank Artiles, who was being paid by operatives who were working for the Florida GOP during the Florida Senate races back in 2020. And in fact, Frank Artiles was being paid to work on South Florida Senate races.
And Artiles is a former senator. He resigned in disgrace after using a racial slur in the presence of some black colleagues. But he continued to be involved and a player in Florida politics.
That's right. He went into political consulting after he left the Senate, and he was a key player in this race. And he ran a political committee, and he continues to be a presence in Florida politics.
So we know Artiles is accused now of funding Rodriguez, but where did the money that Artiles gave to Rodriguez come from, Mario?
So we now know several years after the fact that money came from a political committee, a 501c4 tax-exempt group that was operated by and controlled by Patrick Boehnter. Pat Boehnter is the most powerful guy you've never heard of, folks. He is the chief consultant for the Florida Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. His firm, Data Targeting, does a lot of election work across the state of Florida. And Pat, in a December 2023 deposition given to the state attorney's office public corruption unit in Miami-Dade, basically explained that he had hired Frank Artiles to keep an eye on the races down in Miami-Dade as sort of like an independent watchdog almost, right? Like, I don't know how those folks are spending their money down there. Let me hire Frank. But he also admitted that he'd had discussions with Frank about Frank running a third-party ghost candidate. And when prosecutors asked him about this, he's like, yeah, you know, Frank said he could do it and do it well. Go knock yourself out, right? Well, now we're here.
So he had $100,000 transferred to Pat Boehnter of Data Targeting. It had $100,000 transferred to a dark money nonprofit that was controlled by Artiles called Florida Stronger.
Correct.
But the Data Targeting and Boehnter, they weren't the only source for this money that Artiles was using on the ghost candidates. They weren't the only source of the money that funded
the ghost candidates.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about that. There was a political action committee, Nate, called Grow United, and they also backed the ghost candidates.
Yeah, Grow United is an interesting organization on paper. It was a not-for-profit that was supposed to be advocating for marijuana legalization or the relaxation of marijuana laws. Florida Power and Light claims that it had no role in the creation of Grow United, which, again, on paper, bears no relationship to Florida Power and Light. And yet some of the financial records that the Sentinel got and that, you know, we got and are sort of cross-referenced in other records we've seen show that Florida Power and Light probably did have some hand in the creation of Grow United. Grow United's filing fees were billed to Florida Power and Light. And ultimately, one of the few things I'm aware of that Grow United actually did was make a job offer to Jacksonville City Council member Garrett Dennis. Garrett Dennis was a vocal opponent of privatizing JEA, Jacksonville's city-owned electric, water, and sewer utility. Privatization was one of Florida Power and Light's top priorities in the state and has been throughout 2018, 19, 20. And so Grow United is another very important sort of character, so to speak, in the story.
And Go ahead, Mario.
We should just make it really clear that it's not necessarily proven that Artiles even know Grow United existed, but what we're talking about is Frank got this 100K from Pat Bainter, and he, according to the prosecutors, gave some of this money to the candidate Rodriguez to run, right? But then the pool of money that promotes the three ghost candidates, because there's three, across the state of Florida, that's the money that flows through Grow United.
And Grow United paid for the ads that Mario talked about at the beginning of this segment that were promoting the three ghost candidates as progressives that, you know, in ads that seemed like they were intended to mislead liberal-leaning voters into voting for them instead of the Democrats in those races.
But the connective tissue in all of this is that firm matrix, because we know that Grow United was controlled by two people, April Odom and Jeff Pitts, and at the time they worked for Matrix, and they've since left to work for a company called Canopy Partners. But at the time, they both worked for Matrix. A major Matrix client was FPL, and Matrix billed Florida Power and Light, as Nate said, for the corporate filing fees for Grow United. So that's kind of where we get into the you know, difficult web here, but there are these tentacles that connect all of these things together.
That's right. And it's complicated, and it's intended to be that way. They don't want the public to know where the money paying for these ads is coming from. You know, they don't want to know who was funding. They don't want people to know who was funding these candidates. So that's not a bug. That's a feature. They wanted to confuse voters.
There's always been in Florida politics, you know, reporters, we've always known that there's the surface level politics, which are when you look at the contribution and campaign finance reports, who is giving money. We've always known there was a layer beneath that, which is, you know, these different committees can shuffle money around, and it can be sort of hard to track who's paying for what. But this is all actually about a layer underneath even that. And that's something that you only get to with insider knowledge that comes from stuff like these leaked records. As Annie said, it's intended to be confusing. Listeners are probably picking up on that fact. It almost sounds like tinfoil hat conspiracy stuff, frankly, but the connective tissue is all there. And it's, you know, these Matrix operatives using these weird kind of obscure groups doing all of this kind of nefarious stuff.
And so we know that this group Grow United is formed. Annie, where did Grow United get its money?
It got its money from a group called Let's Preserve the American Dream, which is a political action committee. It received $1.15 million in 2020. And that's that political action committee, Let's Preserve the American Dream, is controlled by Republican pollster Ryan Tyson. He's a former vice president of Associate Industries of Florida, which is a big business lobbying body. And one of the biggest members of Associate Industries of Florida is FPNL.
So Let's Preserve the American Dream. It's a PAC. It's controlled by this, actually a DeSantis advisor, Ryan Tyson, kind of a bigwig in the Republican world. He worked at the time for Associated Industries of Florida, and one of their biggest clients as a lobby organization was FPL.
That's right.
Okay, so they give a bunch of money to Grow United, as you said, over $1 million. And then Grow United in turn provides about half of that to a pair of political committees, Mario. They're both, well, why don't you tell me about that? Who are these two political committees that Grow United is financing at this point?
Yeah, I'm going to forget the names of the political committees, but they were run by an associate of Ryan Tyson called Alex Alvarado, and they were sort of kind of registered to friends of Alvarado's fiance.
Yeah, it was him and his fiance's friends. And these young women were not people who were involved in politics. They had been asked to put their names on these committees and receive some money in return. But they were basically, you know, like the ghost candidates. They were just front men. Yeah, mm-hmm. for these organizations. You know, when we first saw these flyers, we did some research on these political committees whose name appeared on these flyers. And we were, you know, researching the young women whose names appeared on those flyers, and we couldn't find, you know, any information about them in relation to Florida politics. They hadn't, you know, they weren't involved with any other political committees. They weren't involved with any of the major political parties. And so we were really scratching our heads about, you know, who these folks were and what was the purpose of the political committees that they were running.
And they were really caught off guard when the reporting began, right? They were sort of like, what are we, you know, one of them is a roommate of his wife and one of them is a, you know, friend.
Right. And they were texting Alex Alvarado, who's a political consultant, and saying, well, what the heck, you know, reporters are contacting me. What should I say? And, you know, I think that they just didn't understand what he was asking them to do when he asked if he could use their names on those political committees.
And those political committees, in my notes, called The Truth and one's called Our Florida. And they, again, were funded by Grow United. So I want to just reset for a minute. If you're just joining us, we're talking with three investigative journalists who've been reporting for years now on a statewide scandal involving ghost candidates and dark money and the local attempt to sell JEA. You can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect at wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. Nate, so around this time, all this is happening. Florida Power and Light is trying to acquire JEA. Remind us why FPL wanted JEA in the first place and why at one point it seemed that they were destined to get it.
Yeah, so JEA has always been an attractive potential target for Florida Power and Light. It services what is often referred to as kind of the hole in Florida Power and Light's donut in this region. So Florida Power and Light service territory basically spans the entire east coast of Florida, except for Jacksonville. JEA is by public utility standards, a large public utility, one of the largest in the country. And it's got a big customer base. It's got a growing service territory. Jacksonville is one of the fastest growing cities in Florida. And this is just a very logical acquisition target for a large investor owned utility. And so that's not scandalous in and of itself. Utilities buy other utilities. That's kind of how the industry works. But JEA has been one of their top targets for many, many, many years.
We should note, we reached out to both FP&L and JEA and neither were able to comment. Both are also underwriters of WJCT, we should note. But Nate, so they were eyed for acquiring JEA, and ultimately they ended up being the highest bidder had that gotten to that point.
Yes. I mean, so Florida Power and Light, I think it's fair to say they viewed the then mayor at the time, was a Republican, Lenny Curry, who was the former chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. As soon as he got into office, there were people who thought that he might have an interest in privatizing JEA, you know, privatizing it for philosophical reasons, privatizing it for fiscal reasons. Selling JEA would net billions of dollars to the city, or at least that's the common kind of understanding of it. Jacksonville's got a lot of debt. It's got a lot of pension debt. It's got a lot of needs like a stadium renovation. And so his election and FPL's interest in JEA, I think, were kind of, sort of reached a kind of a crescendo around the 2018-2019 window. There are actually multiple efforts to sell JEA. There's a 2018 effort to do it that sort of fizzles out. And then we get into 2019. The mayor helps install a CEO at JEA, who is very open to the idea of putting JEA up for sale and ultimately does.
And so you alluded to this earlier, but when we talk about the tactics that were used in the effort to sell JEA, Grow United was involved in that. And they offered a job to a city council member. Explain to us why that happened or why we think that.
Yeah, as I say, we don't actually know why, at least the records never explicitly discuss why. But Garrett Dennis, he was a political opponent of the mayor's. Garrett Dennis is a Democrat. He became over time a very vocal opponent of even the idea of selling JEA. Here comes Grow United. This obscure group that's doing other stuff around the state. There's ghost candidates. Well, Grow United, which again on paper is supposed to be this sort of pro marijuana legalization advocacy organization, makes an offer to Garrett Dennis through an intermediary for him to take a job with them. And the idea was he was going to be traveling around the country working on marijuana decriminalization issues. The catch was he'd have to leave the city council to do it, thus removing an opponent of privatization from the city council.
Possibly the main opponent on the city council.
Certainly, Garrett Dennis at the time was one of the most, if not the most, outspoken opponents, not just of selling JEA, but of the mayor as well.
And so we do know that this effort was tied directly to Matrix, because FPL confirmed that Matrix suggested creating a job for Dennis in 2019. They said that FPL rejected that idea, and they blamed the founder of Matrix. Explain to us who the founder of Matrix was, and the relationship that, I guess, the split he had with some of his employees that ended up leaving.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way to probably for people to think about this, there were essentially two camps within Matrix. There was a camp affiliated with the then owner of Matrix and still owner of Matrix, a man named Joe Perkins. And there was a camp within Matrix that sort of aligned with the then CEO, Jeff Pitts. So Joe Perkins and Jeff Pitts. I know Mario has done a lot of research into Joe Perkins and Matrix more than I have, but the kind of short version of the story is these two camps have a major falling out with each other. I think some of the reasons for that falling out are mysterious to us, but Joe Perkins' interests seem to revolve around other clients of Matrix's that include a rival utility to Florida Power and Light. While Jeff Pitts is doing work for Florida Power and Light, that might be undermining the interests of those other clients that Joe Perkins at Matrix is also representing. So it became a very messy sort of food fight that does eventually devolve into litigation.
Okay. And we know that the employees that left, I mean, Joe Perkins is still at Matrix. We reached out to both men. We reached out to Joe Perkins. He didn't respond. We reached out to Jeff Pitts. He's the one that left and created Canopy Partners with Stephanie Odom. And he said he can't talk due to the terms of the settlement. But this did, Mario, result in a very acrimonious split, as Nate said, and then has been settled.
Right. Yeah, no, it's been settled. And there's a sort of pail of silence that has descended over the whole thing. But I think there was an Alabama political columnist who once used the phrase a gravity wave to describe the just momentousness of this split and this sort of litigation. And it's a gravity wave that was felt across the power centers of the Southeast United States. Matrix was active in 10 states at least. And they were an incredibly complicated and complex and effective organization, right? This is an organization that has two private airplanes. One is a jet, one is a twin engine propeller. But they settled their dispute, and Canopy is now working independently, sometimes under other names, and Matrix is still working.
Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with more First Coast Connect. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the statewide scandal involving ghost candidates, dark money, and the local attempt to sell JEA. You can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937, or you can email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We've talked about the ghost candidate issue. We've talked about the dark money, but this story also involves something arguably more disturbing, which is surveillance. And Nate, you were actually the target of this surveillance. How did you learn about it?
So, like I described in the outset of this conversation, the Sentinel and the Times Union got over time separate batches of leaked records, leaked internal records from Matrix. It came to me in an email from someone using a pseudonym, a fake name. It essentially was just an attachment with some records. I knew fairly quickly what it was I was looking at, because by then we had been working with the Sentinel and some Matrix and JEA related stories for a while. And one of those documents was a photo of my wife and I walking our dog in Neptune Beach, not very far from the apartment we lived in at the time. The leaker would sometimes provide context for what we were looking at in these emails. And I'm not going to use the leaker. I think this was a single leaker who used different names communicating with different people. That's my speculation, but I think it's a good idea not to share those names. Would sometimes provide context for what we were looking at. I was able to communicate sometimes and draw more records out from time to time, but that's essentially how it came, was just an email attachment.
And so it included a photo, as you say, of you and your wife. Obviously you didn't know you were being photographed, but it also included some sensitive personal information, your social security number, a background check, and also indicated that they had been tailing you. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, there are some records that indicate that in 2019, my wife and I, she was then my girlfriend, but it's now my wife. We were in Pensacola for a friend's wedding in the fall of that year. And we were, I'd been watching, there were a lot of LSU fans in Pensacola, believe it or not. I'm an LSU grad. We were watching an LSU-Alabama game during the reception, sort of huddled around a small TV. And this is kind of a classic LSU-Alabama matchup, comes down to the last minute, LSU wins. And so I had tweeted, probably not super wise of me to do this in hindsight, but just sort of said, you know, hey, LSU won, time to get drunk. That tweet caught the attention of either the private investigator who had been following us or Matrix operatives, because they shared it. And there was this implication that there was some expectation that I was going to be driving intoxicated that night. My wife and I had actually Ubered that night, and the Uber receipt was one of the first sort of pieces of corroborating information that I got to sort of confirm that these records talking about my location in real time were legitimate, because the Uber receipt and the time of these messages being shared sort of matched up. So this is like this would be impossible for someone was faking records to embarrass FPL. This would be, they'd have to be a mind reader of some sort.
And so the documents included text messages from someone doing the surveillance to FPL's vice president of state legislative affairs, that name we heard earlier, Danny Martell.
That's right.
And he received that and responded. So we know that he received that. And there was an exchange where they sent the screenshot of your tweet about getting drunk, and Martell responded, awesome.
Right.
And then that surveillance person later texted, he's in an Uber, with a sad face emoji, as if, as you say, the expectation or the hope was that perhaps you'd be driving drunk.
That is the only takeaway that I can draw away from those messages. And I think that's a very fair interpretation of those messages.
So you spoke to the CEO of FPL when he was still there, Eric Szilagyi, and he said he didn't authorize that.
He said, characterizing what Florida Power and Light said about these messages is frankly a little bit difficult, because they offered lots of different forms of denial. Certainly rejected that they ever had journalists or me specifically surveilled. But as to these records, said they couldn't find them themselves in their own records. So maybe they're real, but we didn't know about them. Maybe these are partially real, but doctored in portions, or maybe some of these are just completely made up. I mean, there's were sort of a series of dissembling explanations. He actually came into our newsroom in our downtown office. Annie was there, and we were actually able to confirm and talk about a lot of stuff that we've talked about here today with him. That was also, I know that was the interview where he confirmed the making JJR's life a living hell, that they authenticated that document.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, again, was the email, Annie, that Danny Martell forwarded to Matrix after getting it from his boss, that said, make this guy's life a living hell. He was the same one that was responding to the surveillance text.
Right. And to be clear, FBNL has denied involvement in the ghost candidate schemes and a lot of the things that we've talked about today. But that did give us confidence that the documents we received, you know, we felt strongly before, I think, going into that interview that they were authentic. But I think his, you know, confirmation that he had sent that email gave us further confidence that those were real. Those were real records that we had received.
The JJR moment in that interview has always stuck out to me because and Mario was sort of dialed in. Yeah. So we hand him this email where he says, "I want to make JJR's life a living hell," paraphrasing. And I sort of expected, just given FPL's general behavior, that they would say this is fake or whatever. He looks at the email, looks at us and says, "Yeah." So, like, as if, like, yes, I did say this. Like, it was a very, he sort of immediately sort of got into why he didn't like JJR.
He was very casual in that moment. Yes. He sort of put his hands up, like, he was shrugging his shoulders and saying, okay, yeah, like you said, so what? What's the big deal?
Yeah.
So this packet of information, Annie, we've talked a little bit about it, but when you first received it at the Sentinel, what all did it contain?
It contained dozens of pages. It was delivered to us in hard copy anonymously. It included check registers, bank statements, emails, texts, invoices, ledgers, covering a 4-year period from 2016 to 2020. And as a reporter, I think this is the type of scene you might imagine in a movie. Like, the reporters get this big dump of documents delivered anonymously, and they're combing through them, and they're getting all of these juicy details about some scandal they've been covering. But really, in real life, that rarely happens. It was just such a strange moment to, you know, just have that delivered, handed to us. And we spent a lot of time going through those and making sure that we could corroborate details in them, because obviously, if we were going to report on them, we need to make sure that they are authentic and not something that somebody is just trying to pull a fast one and get us to report something that's fabricated.
We've got a bunch of comments and emails. I just kind of want to run through them here so that we're airing them and we can address them as we can. Charles emailed, "Wasn't there a ghost candidate in the Melissa Nelson versus Angela Corey race for state's attorney to keep the race in only the Republican primary to close it to Democrats?"
I mean, I would characterize that more as like a spoiler candidate. There's this genre of contrived candidates that run, and as Mario said earlier, this is legal. Like, that running, having someone run to affect a different candidate, like, that is something that happens quite often in Florida politics. That in and of itself is legal and known. That is a known thing that happens.
And so how do you distinguish a ghost from a spoiler?
What distinguishes the three 2020 ghost candidates is the level of sophistication that went into promoting them and into getting them to run, and also the crime, right? The actual election crime here against the laws of the state of Florida, which are that you have to declare your campaign contributions to a candidate. The whole point of the ghost candidate, as opposed to like kind of a third party or spoiler candidate, is that you don't know who is motivating this individual to run. You don't know that their strings are being pulled by, you know, some shadowy figure in the background. And as long as that figure can remain in the shadows, that candidate can have an effect on the race. But if all of a sudden it gets revealed that that third-party candidate, Alex Rodriguez, Justine Iannotti, whoever, is being put forward and manipulated by one of the two parties or corporation in the background, oh, wow, voters can make an informed choice. And it seems like some of the folks running these candidates don't want voters to make an informed choice.
We have a question, Nate, that maybe you can tackle. Someone asking anonymously, "I've always wondered where Carrie Stewart's position was with the sale of JEA. She was a top administrator for the Peyton Curry and JEA administrations, and she has a master's degree specializing in privatization. She obviously has left JEA since kind of when everybody was a house cleaning after the scandal. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I mean, she was part of Aaron Zahn, the then CEO's executive team. I've never viewed her as, there were sort of two tiers of members of the executive team. There was the group closer to Zahn and the group a little bit more removed from Zahn. And she was kind of in that latter group. I don't think there's any intrigue there that we haven't already written about.
We'll call Michael. Go ahead, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. This is the panel of great journalists who've been following this story for years, and is really why I would pay for online journalism. Question, though, is it seems to me that there are two people in the Florida legislature who are holding their seats illegally, and I'm wondering if there's any evidence that Governor DeSantis's elections police have looked into this. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael. So let's talk a little bit about the investigations and the civil cases that emerged from this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, to be clear, right off the bat, none of the people who were actually elected into office have ever been implicated in any of these crimes. They've never been charged. There's no reason to believe that they did anything illegal. But the investigations that have happened have been done by FDLE. They haven't been done by the state elections police. So there's no evidence that any of the people who are elected to office, any of the current sitting senators, are under investigation or in any kind of trouble.
And we mentioned there was 5 indictments on the criminal side. There isn't a state election investigation, but Mario, there was a federal elections investigation.
Yeah, there was a case brought by CREW, which is a watchdog group, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, a complaint before the Federal Elections Commission. The Federal Elections Commission's prosecutory body then sort of evaluated all the evidence and issued a report. And the report said, well, folks, it sure looks like there's fire behind all this smoke. We should open an investigation and find probable cause and kind of go in and get our hands dirty. And the FEC, on a 3-3 vote, deadlocked and did not move forward with the investigation.
And that's a 3-3 partisan split that is kind of defines that body.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Just briefly, because we got to wrap up here, Nate, is there more to come in this?
There are some outstanding threads. There is some civil litigation in South Florida over some of these issues that we've talked about. That could produce more information. There is one active case that should be going to trial in Miami that could produce some interesting information. And of course, the feds, you know, may or may not be doing things at any given time. I think Mario and I both know there has been some at least light interest from the FBI in some of the Matrix stuff, but nothing beyond that, as far as we can tell.
Just briefly, Mario.
Yeah. So there's an active shareholder case, but shareholders in Florida Power and Light sued the company, alleging essentially that it hadn't been honest about its involvement in this whole thing. The lawsuit, obviously FPL denies everything and has moved to dismiss the suit, is in front of Judge Eileen Cannon of Donald Trump case fame. It's kind of moving forward. We don't know yet. I haven't checked in on it in a little bit. If they get to discovery, we may get to learn a lot more.
Nate Monroe, Annie Martin, Mario Ariza, thank you all so much for reporting, and Annie and Mario, especially for making the trip to Jacksonville to discuss those.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stick around. We'll be back in a moment with the First Coast Connect Book Club.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
Dyslexia affects 1 in every 5 Americans, and schools are often the first places where dyslexia is detected. However, tens of thousands of struggling readers are missed because many schools still use a testing model that's almost 50 years old. Is it time to change how dyslexia is diagnosed? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11 on WJCT News 89.9. On the next Fresh Air, WNBA star and Olympic gold medalist Brittany Griner talks about the physical and emotional hell of her nearly 300 days in Russian prisons and what it's like to be reunited with her wife and team, the Phoenix Mercury. She's about to start her second season since returning to the U.S. less than a year and a half ago. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Never miss out on great shows going on around Jacksonville. Find out what's happening on the Jax Music Hour every Saturday night at 8, right here on WJCT News 89.9.
How do chronic conditions like heart disease affect our mental health? Nearly 1 in 5 people who have a heart attack or heart disease also experience depression. But a new study shows that treating anxiety and depression can lower emergency room visits for people with heart conditions, chronic illness, and our mental health. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. I'm joined by First Coast Connect book club host Stacey Goldring to discuss this month's selection. Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning, Anne. How are you?
I'm great. It's so nice to see you. So you have a book about kind of a magical cafe?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not like me. But there you have it, because that's what book club's all about, right? So this book is called Before the Coffee Gets Cold by Toshikazu Kawaguchi, and this was recommended by our very own Michelle Corum. And she reads great books, so I knew this would be a winner.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, so here's the premise of the book, and I'm just going to throw it out at you. What would you do if you could travel back in time? Now, that's the premise of the book, but there are rules. So you're in this magical little cafe tucked away in an alley in Tokyo, right? And there's only one seat in the cafe where you can sit in and go back in time. You can't leave the cafe. And whoever you want to speak to when you go back in time has to, for some reason, have been in the cafe. And you can't do anything to change the present.
Ah.
And you have to finish whatever you were doing, whatever you were trying to accomplish by going back in time, before the coffee gets cold. And that's the title of the book.
Ha!
I know.
So this is not your usual kind of book that you read?
No. I like most of my authors very dead. And this gentleman is very alive and aerobic. And the reason why, and I say it in jest because most authors I like to read, I want to make sure it's worth the reader's time. So you have to stand the test of time. Oh my gosh, I'm saying time way too many times. But you have to stand the test. That's why I usually don't read new authors. But this guy hit the ground running. And this is like one in a series of 5 books. I'm going to read all of them.
Oh, awesome.
I know. This really, it's a cute little book. Look, it's so cute. It's very little. And,
it's a whimsical book, sort of?
Yeah. It's kind of magical realism, like you said. Well, not so much realism. But they're very likable characters. They're all in the cafe. You know, there's the owner. There's the person who serves the coffee. There's the waitress, et cetera. And then they're the people that go back in time. They all want to reconcile something. So there are 4 chapters. So you have 2 lovers, a husband and a wife. You have a daughter and a mother, et cetera. And all these people just want to fix something, even though it's not going to change the present. And if you think about that, that is really, in one sense, it's a gift, like to be able to go back and do that. But in another way, it's kind of a challenge. Like, would you want to go back in time? Like, I wouldn't.
Well, the whole idea of time travel usually is to fix something in the present.
Right. And you can't do that. So it's all about kind of like making amends or trying to find out something that you didn't know so you can understand why the present is happening as it is. It's kind of a mind bender. It's a really good book. And like I said, I read it in 2 days and I'm a slow reader.
So they're traveling through time. So they're kind of having this journey. Are they also evolving as characters as they do it?
So they come back and they've all learned something. And sometimes that's a good thing. And sometimes it's heartbreaking. And sometimes it's enlightening. But that's life. It's really beautifully done. And I found out it's going to be a film.
Oh,
So that's kind of interesting as
well. I saw that maybe it started as a play even before.
Yes, it was a play. It's a film. It's in Japanese. I don't know if they translated it yet. And then it's also going to be a television series. So I can't believe I picked something popular.
Yeah, you're really at the leading edge of this.
It's all Michelle. I give her all the credit.
All right, Stacey. So, I mean, having read this, would you want to travel back in time?
No, I don't do woulda, shoulda, coulda. I just can't. It's too complicated. I don't like that many choices. I just believe in looking ahead. Would you?
Sure. I don't know exactly what my agenda would be, but I mean, if I could time travel, I think I would dip in and out and check out some other times just for fun.
Wow. I'm very impressed. Well, in this case, though, you have to go back in time to fix something.
Sure. I got all things I could
fix.
Oh,
okay.
I mean,
I see.
I've got a long list of things I could fix.
Okay. Well, me too, actually. But I just can't even face it. But it's a fun book because it makes you think about second chances. And who doesn't love a second chance?
Right. And there is an Alzheimer's story, one of them.
There is. And it's so sweet.
I mean,
it's a husband
like
and
chasing
wife.
Chasing kind of like memories of they disappear.
Yes, exactly. And there's a letter involved, which is very interesting. I'm telling you, this author is very clever. And I use clever in the best way because he ties everything up very well.
So if people want to read or not read and still participate in the Chapter Endnotes Book Club, how do they do that?
So they just go to chapterendnotes.com and register. And we meet at San Marco Books and More. And we'll meet Tuesday at 6:30. And if you can't make it, I also have an online book club that meets at 11 a.m. the same day.
So this is Tuesday, May 14th.
Mm-hmm.
And the meeting at 6:30 at night is at San Marco Books and More.
That's right. In the heart of San Marco.
We always love your reading advice, and
aww,
thanks for coming in and giving us this good review.
Thank you.
Will be thrilled.
Oh, well, this is so much fun. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Stacey Goldring, appreciate you being here.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight or find our entire archive at wjct.org or on your favorite podcast platform. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our show is produced by Stacey Bennett and directed by Brady Corum. Our theme is performed by Club de Belugas. Join us tomorrow when we discuss the legacy of former Florida Governor and Senator Bob Graham and how the state politics have changed since his time. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.